Back in the mid-60s, a teenage girl, barely old enough to drive, wrote a novel that broke every rule for young adult fiction.
Something bad can happen at any moment, and there's nothing you can do about it. There's no trusted adult that they turn to. It's entirely on themselves, and people die.
Essie Hinton's The Outsiders, a story about rich and poor kids that's endured for half a century. It's the next installment in our American Icons series. And if we were choosing British icons, one of them would have to be this guy.
Who is my client?
Take a look at where you're standing and make a deduction. You are to be engaged by the highest in the land. Now, for God's sake, put your clothes on.
I'll talk with Stephen Moffat, the British writer behind the new modern Sherlock on PBS. I'm Kurt Anderson. All that's ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Today on the show, we'll hear the latest installment in our series on American icons. S.E. Hinton's The Outsiders is a portrait of high school class struggle that still resonates today.
And you can't win against them, no matter how hard you try, because they've got all the breaks, and even whipping them isn't going to change that fact.
But it's always going to be the haves and the have-nots. You know, the divide is getting bigger and bigger all the time, and this book talks about that. A lot of books for teens and kids do not.
But first, arts in the schools. I'm in favor, and who isn't, right? We all like arts in the schools, but when public money is tight, those budget lines for music and art teachers look so tempting. And with schools obsessing over students' scores on federally mandated tests, arts education gets even shorter shrift. So it was news this week when the Obama administration announced a small experimental program called the Turnaround Arts Initiative, which is aimed at putting more arts in underperforming schools. Eight elementary and middle schools will get about $1 million each, mostly from private grant money, over the next couple of years. Joining me now to talk about this is Diane Ravitch. She's a professor of education at New York University and served in the administrations of the first President Bush as well as Bill Clinton. Diane Ravitch, hello.
Good to be with you.
This initiative gives each of these schools in the first phase something like $500,000 a year. So let's say that's a couple of thousand dollars per kid. If you were one of those principals, how would you go about spending it?
Well, first, I would be thrilled to get this money because this is a time of tremendous fiscal austerity for the schools, and many schools have laid off teachers of all kinds, including arts teachers. So I would go about recreating whatever I lost in the past 5 or 10 years. So this is a wonderful opportunity for that very, very tiny number of schools that will get this money. But the real issue here is this is a teeny tiny little Band-Aid on what is a giant national festering problem. And it doesn't begin to address the needs of the schools because the schools are still locked in an embrace with this testing machine that does nothing to encourage what our society needs.
Right.
Does nothing to encourage kids to be creative or be able to think for themselves. If we have a generation of kids who don't learn how to think for themselves, our whole country's in trouble.
Well, yeah, when you hear that so often that our ace in the hole versus, say, China is this ability to be creative and think outside the box, it almost sounds from what you're describing as though we are deliberately squandering that advantage such as it was. Is there research about the importance of studying art? Certainly commonsensically, yeah, what you say is exactly right. It that's how the people who can think innovatively are created. But do we have evidence showing that that's the case?
Well, there is actually a huge amount of evidence showing that that's the case. Nations that have the highest test scores have the lowest creativity scores by standard metrics of how do you determine which is the most creative, the most entrepreneurial, which produces the most new ideas. On that kind of a measure, we're up there in the very top. China and Japan and the other very test-conscious countries are at the very bottom. and that the more we raise our test scores, the more we sacrifice creativity. So there's quite a lot of evidence for that. This is not the way to produce the jobs of the future. The jobs of the future, we can't even imagine what they are, but they're going to come from not standardized test-prepared people, but rather from people who know how to think outside the box. We're not teaching kids to think outside the box, and this is one of the things that arts can do, is that they can teach creativity. We don't set out to say you're going to be creative, but we encourage creativity during the arts. We encourage children to be, to let themselves go and to paint as they wish and dance freely, to learn the discipline of painting and dancing, but then to come up with new ideas. The very nature of standardized testing is that new ideas are punished.
And as a veteran of a couple of administrations in Washington, do you think this pilot program is, as you say, just a Band-Aid to buy a little favor with the people who want more arts education and aren't crazy about testing?
Well, it's obviously, it is the teeniest, tiniest of Band-Aids. The federal government is never going to be in a position where it is supporting the arts for every school in America. That is simply ridiculous. American education, in the way things are funded, 90% of the money is state and local. The funder of the arts should be and must be the local and state governments. And it has to. The arts have to have a place where they are a secure part of every school's curriculum. The arts are just as important in school as the basic subjects. It is a basic subject, and we have to have that attitude so that when the cutting begins, everybody recoils and says, we are never going to cut the arts. We're never going to cut reading or math or the history or civics or the arts. If there have to be cuts, let's look someplace else, but let's not cut into what everybody knows is a very basic part of a good education, and maybe we have to come up with the idea that we're spending too much on testing. All of our school dollars ought to go to activities that directly benefit children.
That's hard to argue with, and Diane Ravitch, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Well, pleasure to talk to you.
Diane Ravitch is a former Assistant Secretary of Education and the author, among other books, of The Death and Life of the Great American School System. We'd like to hear how you see it where you live, about some local public school that's doing great work in the arts despite the fiscal crises, or one that's given up valuable arts programs. Tell us what you know at studio360.org.
Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about science.
If you're a fan of the latest iteration of the British sci-fi TV series Doctor Who, you can thank Stephen Moffat. He runs the show, and he's the writer behind some of its creepiest and most popular episodes. Last season's finale was BBC America's highest primetime rating ever. And Moffat has recently reinvented another classic British superhero.
The name's Sherlock Holmes and the address is 221B Baker Street.
Moffat and the BBC's new Sherlock is my favorite cinematic version of Sherlock Holmes ever. And it's one of the smartest and most fun new TV shows I've seen in a while. It's set in present-day London and is stylish in every sense. The second season premieres here Sunday night on PBS's Mystery. I asked Stephen Moffat if he could explain to me why making Sherlock Holmes contemporary made me like it so much more.
I think what that did was clear away the dust. It stopped it being a stuffy old icon. It stopped being this sort of, you know, heritage drama, very, very important,
yes,
set in the 19th century and everyone wears a nice frock. It was never about that. It got it back to being fast-paced, you know, sometimes quite silly thrillers. And that's what they are. It's not heritage drama. It's great fun.
And this Sherlock we see in the 21st century is kind of a sociopath, maybe even psychopath on that scale, which I guess the 21st century allows you to fully realize.
Well, do you know, I don't think he is. I think that's what people would be inclined in the 21st century to call him.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And
it's that diagnosis problem.
Yes, we all, and people have done it ever since Doyle created this character. Everyone's wanted to diagnose Sherlock Holmes, and that's a sort of running joke. None of it's true. He's not autistic. He's not a psychopath. He's not a sociopath. He's none of those things. He's a man who chooses to be the way he is because he thinks it makes him better. It's a monastic decision. He takes himself out of touch with his sexuality, out of touch with any of his emotions, in order to make himself better. And that's a sort of frightening idea that somebody could do that.
And to be so unapologetic and shameless about it.
Well, and the reason he's unapologetic and shameless is he's happy in his own skin. He's actually having quite a good time.
I want to play a clip from the new season. This is a scene in which he's given a line of code and the numbers flash across the screen as he instantly deciphers its meaning.
There's a margin of error, but I'm pretty sure there's a 747 leaving Heathrow tomorrow at 6:30 in the evening for Baltimore. Apparently it's going to save the world. Not sure how that could be true, but give me a moment. I've only been on the case for 8 seconds. Oh, come on, it's not code. These are seat allocations on a passenger jet. Look, there's no letter I because it can be mistaken for a 1. No letters past K. The width of the plane is the limit. The numbers always appear randomly and not in sequence. But the letters have little runs of sequence all over the place. Families and couples sitting together. Only a jumbo is wide enough to need a letter K or rows past 55, which is why there's always an upstairs. There's a row 13, which eliminates the more superstitious airlines. Then there's a style of the flight number 007 that eliminates a few more. And assuming a British point of origin, which would be logical considering the original source of the information, and assuming from the increased pressure on you lately that the crisis is imminent, the only flight that matches all the criteria and departs within the week is the 6:30 to Baltimore tomorrow evening from Heathrow Airport. Please don't feel obliged to tell me that was remarkable or amazing. John's expressed that thought in every possible variant available to the English language.
That is Benedict Cumberbatch as the title character in the BBC and PBS series Sherlock. And meanwhile, what listeners don't see is that there's all this textual, visual stuff going on as he's giving, deciphering this complicated message. And throughout the show, there are all these ways in which you sort of merge modern communications technology, text messages and blogging that flash across the screen and follows characters' hands. Was that an idea from the get-go? You thought, oh, there's all this sort of intimate use of technology. This is a great new cinematic opportunity.
But, you know, it arrived, as things often do, by degrees. And it came initially from our very brilliant director, Paul McGuigan, who we made the third episode of our first series first. And in it, there were a lot of text messages. Sherlock Holmes got a lot of text messages. And Paul hates cutting away to a shot of a camera because it's boring.
Which is the way it's always been done so clumsily for the 15, 20 years of the computer age.
And it's horrible. So he said, I'm just going to put the text on screen. That'll be fine. And when he told me that, I thought, that sounds awful. But I walked past the cutting room. I looked in and I saw text floating on screen. I thought, that looks brilliant. I was still writing the first episode of the series, A Study in Pink, in which there's a big deduction sequence where Sherlock Holmes makes a whole lot of deductions about a dead body. And we started putting the deductions up on the screen as well as a sort of a development of that idea. And of course, it's
where he sees a dog hair on a trouser.
Yeah, you actually see a part of his thought process appear on screen.
It's like, really great.
It's like his heads up display. It's how Sherlock sees the world. He actually sees deductions floating in the air in front of him. And that's become a sort of our signature, I suppose, visually.
Well, which is another way in which, wow, no, Sherlock Holmes always should have been done in the 21st century. This intense, dense information flow.
Well, you know, he was, when he first appeared in The Strand, not a historical character at all. He was a very, very contemporary character. In fact, he was a frighteningly modern character. That's what he was meant to be. He was all into science and scary things.
Right.
He was a frightening young man. Slowly, by the stories becoming old, somehow Sherlock Holmes became old and dusty and a relic.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was not that originally.
One of Arthur Conan Doyle's original characters from his stories that you revive in this new season is Irene Adler, who is this amazingly clever player who matches wits with Sherlock throughout the first episode, and then at the end goes for the jugular.
Have you ever had anyone?
Sorry.
And when I say had, I'm being indelicate.
I don't understand.
I'll be delicate then. Let's have dinner.
Why?
You might be hungry.
I'm not.
Good.
Why would I want to have dinner if I wasn't hungry?
Mr. Holmes, if it was the end of the world, if this was the very last night, Would you have dinner with me?
Sherlock?
That is Laura Pulver as Irene Adler in the new series of Sherlock. So you made her absolutely as icy and brilliant as he.
Yes. I mean, that was... It's Sherlock versus the possibility of attraction, I suppose.
And would it be so bad if he fell in love? Or is he incapable?
Well, love... I mean, this is love among the deranged, isn't it? Is it love? It's two predators circling each other in a kind of mutual fascination.
It's like some version of X-Men, I guess, right?
Yes. You think, oh, God, I'm not the only one. God, there's two.
Even though...
there's a girl one.
Exactly.
Me.
Exactly. And a naked girl one.
Yeah. Yowza.
There's lots of amusing passing anti-Americanism in the show.
Is there?
Too.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Surely that's just natural, isn't it? What have I said? Sorry, go on. Tell me.
No, just the most unlikable villain character, for instance, in the first episode of the new season is an American. And it just goes without saying in banter that he's an American.
Okay, well, maybe it's my personal revenge for the fact that every Hollywood film, when they want someone really evil and villainous, and in particular a Nazi, gets an English actor to play it.
It's true. Every single time.
Times I've been wanting to write to you lot and say, you realise the Nazis weren't actually British.
Really?
No, that's a fact.
True enough. Speaking of villains, you've got a wonderful Moriarty in the series, played by Andrew Scott. You've also had experience writing serious, significant, beloved villains on Doctor Who the last few years. What makes a great villain in this century?
It's interesting. I think someone who genuinely frightens you. And I think being frightening has become different. I mean, the original Moriarty in the story. So Moriarty is the element of Sherlock that we have departed the furthest from. Without doubt, because the original Moriarty is suave, accomplished, a relatively typical supervillain. Over a century later, that kind of villain seems rather cosy, seems rather reassuring. I think what we're frightened of now is unpredictability. Someone who just, we don't understand the mindset of that person.
Like the Joker and the Batman.
Yeah, just someone who might do anything at all, might, you know, have no personal fear of themselves or for themselves. You know, in the suicide bomber age, we're frightened of people who don't prioritize their own survival.
A different American network, CBS, is now developing a modern Sherlock Holmes that is not officially a remake of your version. Is that the sincerest form of flattery, as they say?
Is that the sincerest form of flattery? I can think of more sincere ones.
Paying you, I guess.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Well, what can we say about that? I'll monitor my wife's face as I answer this question. CBS did approach us about
the version. He's literally monitoring her face.
Yes, I know, because the wife's the boss, let's be clear. CBS did approach us about remaking our version of Sherlock, and we said we didn't want to do that yet. And they said, well, keep in touch. If you ask around, we are people of great integrity, and you can trust us. Sometime later, they announced they were doing one anyway.
And did they announce that they're no longer people of great integrity?
I have no updates currently on their integrity.
You can only hope it'll be terrible, so you don't have to worry.
That's not the point. I don't want it to be terrible because actually it kind of degrades the brand a bit if it is. But Sherlock Holmes is always an immense thing. You're never going to be the only Sherlock Holmes. Never mind the cinema one that's going on now, which I like very much, by the way. You've also got the old ones showing on television. Basil Rathbone still solving crimes on your television. So is Jeremy Brett.
And you've got House too, right?
You've got House being a very, very brilliant, very different version of a Sherlock Holmes. I think it's just a demonstration of the huge appetite there is for that character and the very, very different ways in which you can realise him.
Stephen Moffat, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
The second season of Sherlock begins on PBS's Masterpiece Mystery this weekend. And Doctor Who fans, I did not forget about you. I asked for your questions for Stephen Moffat and got some of the answers. You can listen to those at studio360.org as well as to our entire uncut conversation. Coming up, a classic teen novel became a Francis Ford Coppola movie, and then, for some people, the stuff of fantasy.
When the rumble happens, it's just like buff dudes in wet t-shirts. Not only are you like muddy and rolling around, but you're like fighting the man.
The Outsiders, Our latest American icon is up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The mega franchise in young adult fiction today is The Hunger Games. But that category really didn't even exist before S.E. Hinton came around. 45 years ago, she was just a kid herself when she published a novel about rival cliques in her hometown of Tulsa. It was called The Outsiders. The book was an instant hit and has sold more than 13 million copies. It was also made into a movie by Francis Ford Coppola that starred every 1980s heartthrob. Tom Cruise, Patrick Swayze, Rob Lowe, Ralph Macchio, Matt Dillon. As part of our series on American icons, Lou Olkowski went to Tulsa, Oklahoma to get the story from S.E. Hinton herself.
I made a D in creative writing the year I was writing The Outsiders. I love bringing that up.
Susan Eloise Hinton was a sophomore at Will Rogers High School in Tulsa when she began The Outsiders. You probably know her as S.E.
The use of my initials came about because my publishers didn't want the first reviewers to see a book about social class warfare, mainly about boys, and see it was written by a girl and think, well, a girl wouldn't know anything about this. But one day when a friend of mine got beat up on his way home from school, I got mad and began a short story. And that was the beginning of The Outsiders.
When I spotted that red Corvair trailing me, I was almost two blocks from home then, so I started walking a little faster.
Set in the early 1960s, The Outsiders is about a bunch of poor kids, the greasers, who are terrorized by the rich kids, the socias.
I had never been jumped, but I had seen Johnny after four socias got a hold of him, and it wasn't pretty.
It's told from the perspective of Ponyboy, one of the youngest greasers. Like Nick Carraway from The Great Gatsby, that other great book about social class, Ponyboy watches it all.
I remember Johnny, his face all cut up and bruised, and I remember how he had cried when we found him, half conscious in the corner lot.
I lived The Outsiders. I think that's why it's so immediate to people, because I was in that book living it.
Missy Hinton still lives in Tulsa. And she still drives past the places that inspired the book.
I will take you through the Socias neighborhood. It's where the old oil mansions are.
I have to say, it's hard to not feel kind of poor driving through this neighborhood.
No kidding. As you can see, the rich people here are very rich. I mean, very rich. And the pockets of poverty are very, very poor. So you do have two extremes.
The extremes were most obvious. And how kids dressed. The socias wore button-down shirts.
Meanwhile, the greasers, you know, blue jeans, white t-shirts, black leather jackets. And, of course, anybody could dress like that, but you wouldn't do it unless you were a greaser. Next stop is going by the high school. Back there in the back parking lot was where the greasers hung out, but the socias hung out in that main entrance, so you just didn't use that entrance.
The greaser kids would actually come into school from the other door?
Oh, yeah. You didn't go through that door. Unless you were social. But it wasn't, like, imposed by the adults, the school, or your parents, or anything. It was kids imposing rules on themselves.
In fact, adults barely show up in The Outsiders. It's an all-teenage world. Created by a teenager.
I started off typing on my father's, it was an antique even then, Underwood. And man, I must have had some muscles in my fingers because I still have that thing and it's not easy to.
Hey, Grease, one said in an over-friendly voice. We're going to do you a favor, Greaser. We're going to cut all that long, greasy hair off.
At one point, Ponyboy and his best friend Johnny get jumped by the socias again. But this time, they fight back, and Johnny accidentally kills one of them with a switchblade.
Something bad can happen at any moment, and there's nothing you can do about it.
That's Elizabeth Bird. She works in the kids section at New York Public Library.
There's no higher power that they ever call upon at any moment. There's no trusted adult that they turn to when things are getting rough. It's entirely on themselves. And people die.
Circumstances under which I was writing, which I don't want to go into, but personally it was very, very difficult.
When she was 15, Hinton's father was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And the more and more time he spent in the hospital, the more time she spent writing.
One of the things I really loved about writing was getting to be in another world.
When Essie finished The Outsiders, she gave it to a friend whose mother wrote children's books. She thought it was good enough to go to an agent.
But I was idle conversation with my mother. I said, you know, if I ever sold my book, could I get a car? And she's going, sure, hon. You sell your book, you get a car. And my younger sister hears this, and she's like, sell your book, we'll get a car, we'll get a car. And she's the one that actually bundled it up and sent it off.
Viking, the second publisher to see it, snatched up the publishing rights, and Essie got her car.
It was first year Camaros came out, so I got a Camaro, and my sister was running around going, I sent the book in, and she put the first dent in the car, too.
The Outsiders definitely changed things.
It led the way towards a whole new genre of writing for teenagers called New Realism.
And you got some very brave books. Prior to The Outsiders, there wasn't this established understanding that teens liked dark fiction, which is so funny today when you consider like the huge swaths of depressing teen literature that they just gobble up like crazy.
But for all of its realism, The Outsiders has some pretty far-fetched plot twists. After killing the Soche, Johnny and Ponyboy go on the run. Their friend Dally, the toughest and coolest of the greasers, gives them some money, a gun, and tells them to hide out in an abandoned church. Then there's a fire, and Johnny and Ponyboy rescue some little kids who just happen to be there.
There's a field trip at the abandoned church? Are you kidding me? Like, it makes no sense whatsoever.
And this is coming from a fan, Heather Och, a performer and high school drama teacher.
My first copy of The Outsiders was given to me by Mrs. Hark, who was my English teacher in junior high. I thought she was really cool. She wore dangly earrings. I just remember I loved it immediately. I really did.
Still, Heather remembers cringing when Johnny and Ponyboy kill time reading Gone with the Wind.
What little dudes are going to hang out and read Gone with the Wind to each other?
It doesn't have a reputation of being an ooey-gooey novel, even though it has some really, touching, sweet moments between them.
You ain't like any of the gang. I mean, I couldn't tell Tubit or Steve or even Derry about the sunrise and clouds and stuff. I mean, they just don't dig. Johnny shrugged. Yeah, he said with a sigh. I guess we're different.
Some of it's false, like it's over-the-top emotions. And, the drama are what make it so popular because that's the way kids really feel. You gotta have the hormones going before you can really appreciate that book.
Which is why, every school year, there's a new generation of teenagers who eat it up. Back in 1983, one of those teens was Christy Bishop. She was an eighth grader at Lone Star Junior High School in Fresno, California.
I read it and then reread it and read it again and read it probably three more times.
Which meant Christy got to know the school librarian, Joellen Misakian, pretty well.
And so she's like, well, here, let's make a petition and we will send it off to Francis Ford Coppola. Just looking back at the petition, it's so cute because, it's seventh and eighth grade girly handwriting with big hearts and flowers and smiley faces.
I have a copy of that letter. Hi, I'm Ralph Macchio. I played Johnny Cade in the film The Outsiders. And that's just the greatest story. Coppola tells that story all the time.
Amazingly, the petition worked. As they began to adapt the story, Coppola's producer, Fred Roos, kept in touch with the students. Early on, Fred even asked for their feedback on the script. Joellen went to L.A. to give him notes in person.
I just said, Fred, we really don't like the script. It's not true to the book. We just don't like it.
It is kind of ballsy.
I know. You're right. You're right. It is ballsy.
But they rewrote the script. As the film was in production, Jo Ellen organized conference calls with Coppola and the film's heartthrob cast.
Be quiet.
Matt Dillon, C. Thomas Howell.
No wiggling.
And Ralph Macchio.
Hello, is this Ralph Macchio?
Yeah, how are you?
That's so me.
Wow, we're just great. Go ahead, cheer.
Nearly 30 years later, Ralph Macchio still remembers the kids in Fresno.
I would like to know, how did you like your role in The Outsiders?
I like the role. I love The Outsiders. That book, I read the book in seventh grade. The same, I guess, same as most of you. And
I was obviously very excited.
Hi, I'm a teacher here at Lone Star School. And I'd like to know, what message would you like to get across to your audiences through this role?
Just believe in, yourself. Because that was Johnny's problem in his whole life. He never believed in himself. He never had confidence in himself. He was always nervous he was going to get beat up again. And towards the end of the movie, he started gaining confidence in himself.
It was at that point before they go in to save the kids when Johnny starts telling Dallas what they're going to do.
We're going back. We're going to turn ourselves in.
What?
I got a good chance of being let off easy. It was self-defense, you just said. Pony and Jerry can testify to that.
And all of a sudden, you just see him come out of his shell.
So you won't get in any trouble, Dal.
Are you sure? This is what you want to do?
Yeah, I'm sure, man. It ain't fair for Johnny.
It would be really interesting to see how Johnny would have progressed from that point, because there was he took the reins.
But Johnny never gets the chance. With Dally and Ponyboy at his side, he dies from the burns he got rescuing the kids in the church fire. But his experience of finding himself after being uncomfortable in his own skin rang true for thousands of teenagers.
If you're a freak, a weirdo, an outcast, an outsider in any way, you love those stories. You want those stories. And that really can help lift you up.
The other thing the book has going for it is sex appeal. It's a teenage girl's fantasy about teenage boys. And with the movie, Coppola ran with it. For Heather, the drama teacher, it was a major turn-on.
I'm watching it and I'm like, oh my God, it's so homoerotic. Totally softcore porn. For me, I mean, when Johnny kills the Soche, everybody gets wet. When the rumble happens, everybody gets wet. It's just like buff dudes in wet t-shirts, like, for a large portion of the movie. Oh, the rich people trying to keep me down. We'll fight them. Great. Take your shirt off. Like, roll around in the mud. I want the rain coming down. Yes. Not only are you, like, muddy and rolling around, but you're, like, fighting the man.
The outsider, with his blue jeans, leather jacket, and slicked back hair, became Heather's romantic ideal.
I wanted this person. I wanted the person who was going to, read a poem and talk to me about the sunset and then would go kick somebody's ass and they were going to f*** with me.
But she didn't necessarily want a man. Heather knew she wasn't alone, so she decided to stage a live performance of The Outsiders.
In the role that was made famous by Ralph Macchio.
I love the story of The Outsiders. Who do I want to be in it? A bunch of random dudes? No. I want my world of people. Like, let's do this. This is for us.
Her people are gay or queer or butch or trans.
If you get cold.
Because there wasn't a book that was a bunch of queer freaks, doing what they were doing. Like, we placed ourselves on those white boys, We're like, yeah, they're standing up. They're standing up to the socias. They're standing up to the rich people. They're standing up to the people who are putting them down. We were able to, take that and make it our own.
Maybe The Outsiders continues to attract a wide audience because so many of us have felt bullied or marginalized and feel like there's always a group of insiders who live by different rules.
And you can't win against them, no matter how hard you try, because they've got all the breaks, and even whipping them isn't going to change that fact.
45 years later, The Outsiders' story of class warfare is as relevant as ever. Again, librarian Betsy Bird.
That might be the element to it that has survived unchanged then or now. That is always going to be the haves and the have-nots. The divide is getting bigger and bigger all the time, and this book talks about that. A lot of books for teens and kids do not.
By the end of The Outsiders, Dally, the super tough guy, is so distraught by Johnny's death that he kills himself in a standoff with the cops. But for the rest of the greasers, everything goes back to the way it always was.
Ponyboy is poor at the outset of the novel, and he is poor at the end of the novel.
Eric Tribunella is a professor of children's literature at the University of Mississippi.
His older brother had wanted to be a football star and go to college, but he can't do that because he's got to stay home and take care of his younger brothers. And that is not resolved at the end of the novel because there is no resolution.
In the final tear-jerking pages, Ponyboy finds a goodbye letter from his friend Johnny.
Like green. When you're a kid, everything's new. Like the way you dig sunsets, Pony. That's gold. Keep it that way. It's a good way to be. And don't be so bugged over being a greaser. You still have a lot of time to make yourself be what you want. There's still lots of good in the world. Tell Dally. I don't think he knows.
It ends on what appears to be this hopeful note that Ponyboy is going to finish high school, that he's going to go off to college, and that maybe he will attain middle-class status and all will be well.
Which made sense to high school sophomore Susan Eloise Hinton. But now, in the age of the 99%, Ponyboy's future feels a little less hopeful.
The alternative is for Ponyboy to get a bunch of his friends and occupy Wall Street. I mean, the alternative is some kind of broader social movement. But that's not where Ponyboy goes. That's not where the novel goes.
Instead, as a response to Johnny's letter and as makeup work for his English class, Ponyboy writes the story of the Outsiders.
I could picture hundreds and hundreds of boys living on the wrong sides of cities. Boys with black eyes who jumped at their own shadows. Hundreds of boys who maybe watched sunsets and looked at stars and ached for something better. Someone should tell their side of the story.
I was just telling the truth about what I saw going on. You know, that part of it's timeless. The names and the uniforms change, but it doesn't matter.
There will always be outsiders. The only question is, can the outsiders ever find something better? For Studio 360, I'm Lou Olkowski.
Have you got a story about the outsiders? How'd you feel the first time you read it? Tell us at studio360.org. And if you don't believe that story about Ralph Macchio and the kids in Fresno, we've got pictures on our website. Coming up, Elaine Pagels is America's most important scholar of religion, which means she gets really good hate mail.
The most interesting one said that I and the president of Princeton, Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and Joel Osteen and the Pope were all going to hell. And I mean, that I can laugh at.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Last week, I talked with the poet Tracy K. Smith, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for her book called Life on Mars. That's also the title of a David Bowie song, and Smith's poems are filled with references to Bowie. So we gave you a challenge. Write your own poem about a rock star or other artist you've worshipped.
This is Vicki Warner of Providence, Rhode Island. And my poem is about Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin. The song Remains the Same became an indoctrination. Robert Plant was the handsome strutter, but Jimmy Page, the skinny, heavy-lidded mystery who wore his satin dragon pants too high and his Gibson defiantly low, treated me to my first taste of psychedelia.
We're still taking submissions. Send us your poem at studio360.org. The deadline for the contest is this Sunday at midnight Eastern Time. And Tracy K. Smith will be back on the show to announce the winner she's picked. Elaine Pagels is hands down the most well-known and probably the most important American student of early Christianity. 30-odd years ago, she wrote a scholarly work about gospel stories that didn't make it into the Bible, the so-called Gnostic Gospels, and it became a bestseller, which you could count as a small miracle right there. She's gone on to write about women and sex in Christianity, about Satan, and much more. Her influence is huge, both in the academic world and, thanks to Dan Brown's interest in her scholarship, everywhere else. Her new book is about the Book of Revelation, that super weird apocalyptic blockbuster conclusion to the Bible. Angels battling demons in heaven, the beast with the number 666, the Antichrist, the end times.
The Revelation chapter 13. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy.
Elaine Pagel's book is called Revelations, Visions, Prophecy, and Politics in the Book of Revelation. Professor Pagels, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So if we showed the Book of Revelation to somebody who knew nothing of Christianity, didn't know about the Bible, he might conclude that the author was mentally disturbed. How would you start explaining what this is to this hypothetical ignoramus?
I would say to somebody from a different culture that this is the highly imaginative, dreamlike fantasies of somebody who is very worried about world events and particularly worried about war, and has taken the way he interprets it from a culture which prophesies sort of first doom to the world and then final restoration of justice.
Well, and you talk about it in this book. You talk about Revelation as a work of wartime, traumatized wartime literature with very specific context. Explain that.
Well, yes, this is the Book of Revelation. I mean, as you know, it starts out as a Jewish prophet says he's receiving messages from someone who died and came back from the dead, whom he identifies as Jesus of Nazareth, and says the world has been taken over by evil forces, and God is about to send sort of violent plagues and wrath and terror on the earth and war. And after that, he's going to destroy all the evildoers and start the world all over again. It sounds like a completely fantastic, catastrophic kind of story, although it's one that you find in stories like, you know, Lord of the Rings or Star Wars, actually.
And speaking of the popular culture that it has inspired, 1,000 horror movies about the Beast and 666, I want to play a bit of one of those.
A sequence of sixes. From the eternal sea he rises, creating armies on either shore, turning man against his brother. Till man exists no more. Your son, the son of the devil.
So that's from The Omen. And indeed,
oh, yes.
in the Book of Revelation, there is, this 666 thing is there, and you posit an explanation for why those numbers, what that meant.
Yes. Well, as you said, this prophet could be considered crazy or just paranoid, but I think we need to understand he's somebody dealing with wartime. And that is a code way of talking probably about the enemy power, in this case, the head of the Roman Empire, because in Jewish mystical tradition, you have a numerical equivalent for every letter. And Jews were often hiding code names that way. So this is probably the code name of the Emperor Nero, who was taken by many people, both Romans and Jews and others, to be sort of the epitome of the worst of Roman rule. But because the Romans had crushed his people, this prophet is adamantly opposed to the force of evil he sees embodied in this Antichrist, this beast, this one with this number.
And you suggest, again, that this was encoded and his fear and loathing of Rome was expressed allegorically. it sounds like to keep himself safe, maybe, from being killed by his Roman oppressors. Which makes me think, hey, he's not so crazy. He knew what he was doing, right?
I think he knew exactly what he was doing. He was a follower of Jesus. And, you know, Jesus had been crucified for sedition against Rome. Peter had been crucified. Paul had his head cut off. Jesus' brother James was stoned to death. So it was dangerous, belonged to this movement. And the Romans were very suspect of Jews after the Jewish war against Rome, which ended in the year 70. In the complete destruction of Jerusalem. Even today, if you walk in Jerusalem, you see where the Romans destroyed the entire city center, and the rubble of that war is still right there.
So this prophet, who is John, not the John we know best from the Bible, but John of Patmos, this is an enormous feat of speculation I'm asking you to
sure.
do, but if John of Patmos were aware of the fact that the Book of Revelation is still regarded as a guide to the imminent future by many, many believing Christians around the world, would that shock him, please him, or was he just writing about what he expected to happen in 90 AD?
Well, you know, it's hard to read the mind of somebody who hasn't been around for 2,000 years, but
yes. But
it does seem to me that he was reading the prophecies of Jesus that said, you know, within a generation, the kingdom of God would come. So my own guess is that he thought it would happen very soon. But what he did is write in such amazing, vivid images that people have been able to plug in almost any conflict ever since into that same set of images, whether it's, you know, up to the American Civil War, up to the war in Iraq and World War II.
Right. Well, and speaking of the writing, it seems so different from the writing of the disciples who knew Jesus personally. It seems almost as if it's from a different religion.
You know, it does. That's why Martin Luther said the Bible should not have this book in it because there's no Christ in it. Interestingly, this is written about 60 years after the death of Jesus, and most scholars think it's not the John who wrote the Gospel of John, and it's also not the John who was the disciple of Jesus because the dating doesn't quite fit, nor does he claim to be. But rather, it's somebody who thinks very much like the ancient prophets in terms of war.
And was part of its appeal to people wanting to claim and enforce authority for a church the fact that it could be used to scare the bejesus out of followers?
It certainly has always been used to scare people. and the person who actually inserted it into the Bible basically said, well, you see, what this means is that all who believe what Orthodox Christians believe are going into heaven, and all those who believe the opposite, or heaven forbid, are not Christians at all. They're either heretics or Jews or pagans are simply going into eternal damnation. And that's been, you know, one of the lines that some Christians have pursued ever since.
But in the last decade or so, we've seen apocalyptic, end timesy tropes spiking all over the culture in novels like Cormac McCarthy's The Road and even on the left side of the political discourse concerning climate change. Is this, to some extent, a cycle that happens? Do people just get freaked out every few decades that the end is nigh?
Well, that's probably true. I was talking to the sociobiologist E.O. Wilson, who's very much concerned about sociobiology. He was brought up, as Cormac McCarthy was, in sort of Bible-believing Southern Christianity. And he says when he talks about ecology, he gives them the fear of hell, and then he gives them the sermon, and then he gives the altar call. I mean, he was laughing, but he said this is how he talks about. But that's a very different scenario, I think, because it does involve, say, the survival of all people on earth and not just, you know, who's going to kill whom. So I think it may be preferable.
as a Christian yourself who has spent her life studying the nature, history of Christianity, have your own belief systems or beliefs changed over the course of your life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what I've realized is that, you know, Christianity is a very wide and broad tradition, and there are many elements of it. I mean, I couldn't swallow the whole thing, so I have to examine it and explore it. It seems to me that there are very different concerns Christians have today, and one of them is do people really believe that only Christians are people who have access to the divine? I mean, I think many people who call themselves Christians would not agree with that, although some would. So there are these battles within various Christian groups, and many who love the book of Revelation would disqualify me because I'm not in their particular group.
And do you hear from them? Do you hear from unhappy Christians?
Oh, I do. Yes, quite a bit.
What do they say?
Some of them, of course, say that I'm not a Christian because I don't share their view of it.
So speaking of unhappy Christians who regard you as a heretic, you told me before we started that you'd just gotten some hate mail. What did the hate mail say?
The most interesting one said that I and the president of Princeton, Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, and Joel Osteen and the Pope were all going to hell. And I mean, that I can laugh at.
That's a bunch of strange bedfellows.
Yeah, I thought it was. I thought it was interesting company.
Elaine Pagels, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Elaine Pagels is the author of Revelations and many other books about Christianity. But if rock gods are more your thing, don't forget to submit a poem about one of them at our website, studio360.org. A couple of weeks ago, we told you about a new audio project called Passing Stranger. It's a wonderful walking tour of the poets and poetry that flourished in New York's East Village neighborhood over the years. One thing we forgot to mention is that the tour was created by our own former colleague, Pike Malinowski. You can hear some of the great stories he produced for us over the years and learn more about Passing Stranger at studio360.org. And that is it for today's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next time. Studio 360 is produced by PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Our production team is
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Max Bernstein,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360's American Icons Project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life. Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. And by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the music industry is looking for the next big app.
They're almost treating developers like they would treat emerging artists. They're almost like the talent scouts from the 60s and 70s.
And the geeks get their chance to shine. It's Hack Day, and the future of music might start here. Next time in Studio 360, from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.